what to do with mechanical ventilation.
Don't be afraid to start antibiotics.
The thing that makes me nervous and anxious is watching people hyperventilate the post-cardiac arrest patient.
It couldn't be any more critical than this.
We have to be very, very cautious.
Meticulous respiratory care makes a difference.
Remember, less is more in these patients.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, joined by my outstanding three co-hosts here on CCPEM, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Peter, let me turn to you and say a big hi, and hopefully, last we talked, you were about ready to get into Mardi Gras. How did you weather the storm?
So Mardi Gras went just fine. It's, again, a great time to be in New Orleans. Now we get revved up into our festival season with French Quarter Festival and Jazz Festival coming up pretty soon. So it's a good time to be in the city. And we had 80-degree temps this week.
Wow. I can definitely vouch for a good time in New Orleans. My wife and I have attended Jazz Fest before, and it's really just a phenomenal event with wonderful music and wonderful food. Rob, how are things out west in California?
Doing well. We've been busy, high volumes in the ED, and otherwise doing pretty well.
Great. And John, the city of brotherly love.
Well, Philadelphia has been inundated with influenza this season, and we're finally on the downslope. But looking forward to a little trip coming up down to San Antonio, Texas for SCCM that's coming up. Should be a good time. We're presenting some research about some some exciting research on mitochondrial function and perfusion in sepsis. But it looks to be a good conference. I'm excited to get down and meet some old friends and learn some new things.
Lots of people headed that way, for sure. Well, let's get to our educational topic this month, and we are going to circle back on an aspect of post-cardiac arrest care. We're not going to do the whole thing in its entirety, but really focus on what to do with mechanical ventilation. So how to adjust the ventilator in the patient you've just gotten ROSC on. Now, this is based on a really superb article that just came out in Chest by lead author Dr. Johnson. Dave Gajewski is also on this. It's entitled Ventilator Management and Respiratory Care After Cardiac Arrest. And this is something that all of us deal with, I'd hate to say on a daily basis, but absolutely once a week we are engaged in cardiac arrest resuscitation. And many times we do get ROSC back. Patients may not ultimately leave the hospital or survive to hospital discharge, but we need to do everything that we can to maximize the chances that patients do get discharged with meaningful neurologic survival. And when it comes down to aspects of the ventilator management, it couldn't be any more critical than this. So we know that over 500,000 patients, family members, friends experience cardiac arrest each year in the United States. And we know that a comprehensive algorithm that would include targeted temperature management, hemodynamic optimization, appropriate neuroprognostication, and then, as we're talking about here, meticulous respiratory care makes a difference. We're going to touch on what should be our target O2 concentrations, what should our target CO2 concentrations be, what type of infections should you be on the lookout for that occur in many of these ROSC patients, and why are they at really high risk for developing ARDS. So, with that, let's talk about the optimal approach to mechanical ventilation that will improve the outcomes in these patients. Rob, tell us a little bit about what's going on. We get ROSC back. I've heard of this thing called post-cardiac arrest syndrome. Enlighten us a little bit more on why this is important to know as we talk about mechanical ventilation.
Yeah, Mike. So there are basically four key components to the post-cardiac arrest syndrome. Those are brain injury, myocardial dysfunction, systemic ischemia, and reperfusion injury. And then there's the component of you have to consider what was the precipitating event or etiology that led to the cardiac arrest. So from a pathophysiology standpoint, the post-cardiac arrest syndrome results in a number of abnormalities, including oxidative stress, coagulopathy, widespread inflammation, and multi-organ dysfunction that affects, again, all the organs at the same time. Unfortunately, the brain is particularly sensitive to these changes, with alterations in macrocirculatory and microcirculatory blood flow causing problems, post-cardiac arrest has impaired cerebral autoregulation, and then their abnormal metabolism of various products from the post-cardiac arrest syndrome. And all of these lead to further brain injury. Something that we've talked about in the past is hyperoxia. And we've talked about how superoxide levels, superoxygenation, post-cardiac arrest can exacerbate free radical production, mitochondrial dysfunction, and neuronal injury. And then secondary cerebral injury is also common, as patients with post-cardiac arrest syndrome have an elevated cerebrovascular resistance. Then finally, post-cardiac arrest syndrome patients are at risk for immune dysfunction and therefore more susceptible to infections. So we've talked about hemodynamic optimization that has been shown to improve outcomes in patients with post-cardiac arrest syndrome. John, what about oxygenation, ventilation, and low tidal volume strategies?
No, absolutely, Rob. So oxygenation is something I think we all pay a good amount of attention to whenever a patient is on the ventilator, striking the right balance. And this balance of sufficient oxygen delivery to essentially meet the metabolic demands of the cells that the patient is having while also preventing excessive oxygenation or hyperoxia, because this certainly can increase, as you said, Rob, free radical production and can really cause some damage, add fuel to the fire, if you will, in this ischemia reperfusion injury cycle that the patient's experiencing once they achieve ROSC. So as we're thinking about what oxygen level we'd like to have, we want to avoid hypoxemia because certainly excessively low oxygen levels can exacerbate ongoing ischemia, cause irreversible cell injury and organ dysfunction. But certainly this hyperoxemic effect can, as you said, increase oxidative stress, amplify free radical production, and worsen organ function as well. Now, if we look to the preclinical studies about how oxygenation impacts patients or test animals post-arrest, animals had improved outcomes and decreased neurologic injury when they had a lower FiO2 post-arrest. So certainly a high oxygen level might not be all that beneficial. And then when we look to retrospective analyses of human subjects, which have performed to investigate relationship O2 tension, mortality, and neurologic outcome in post-arrest patients, this is what we found. So 100% FiO2 is associated with higher neuron-specific enolase levels, which is basically a cell marker of brain or neuron injury compared to those patients with lower FiO2 levels. Hyperoxemia, defined as a PO2 greater than 300, is associated with increased mortality. And the higher PO2 essentially is associated with mortality and poor neurologic outcome. Now, other studies have found some mixed results, but these retrospective studies used a variety of cutoffs for hyperoxemia, so a little bit of heterogeneous definitions, and hypoxemia as well. And also, there is a consideration of blood gas sampling levels and duration of exposure to these O2 levels. So the hyperoxic or normoxic therapy trial was the only prospective trial of titrated O2 after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And here's what they found. Essentially, all patients had initial rhythm of VFib or pulses VT, and they were randomized to a titrated O2 therapy of SpO2 of 90% to 94%, or essentially a standard therapy of SpO2 greater than 95%. Now, the only concerning thing about this is we all struggle with this high SpO2 level, because certainly if the pulse ox is 100%, you really don't know what the PaO2 is underneath unless you check it. And I think that early on, a lot of people probably aren't quickly checking PaO2s right off the bat, often going by sats. So this trial was stopped early after just a few patients reached a pre-specified endpoint, and it really didn't provide any information at all that would be clinically helpful. Now, there was a second study, that the oxygen ICU trial that we talked about previously on an episode of CCPM, but they didn't really specify how many patients were post-arrest, so wasn't all that helpful either. So in general, the recommendation is that we should titrate our FiO2 to maintain a pulse ox between 92 and 97%, which if you calculate that out, it ends up approximating a PaO2 of about 100 millimeters of mercury immediately after ROSC. So again, we're trying to figure out what the right dose of oxygen is after cardiac arrest. Certainly don't want to be hyperoxic, but definitely don't want to be hypoxic either. Now, the flip side to any patient who's on a ventilator is the PCO2, so the ventilation goals. So Peter, why don't you talk to us a little bit about the important things to think about post-cardiac arrest for ventilation?
So great pearls about oxygenation, John. In my shop, it's not unusual to have high flow oxygen going to our patients, particularly post-cardiac arrest. But the thing that makes me nervous and anxious is watching people hyperventilate the post-cardiac arrest patient, particularly from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Once they get ROSCE, typically whoever is bagging the patient is very anxious. And so it's very important that we pay great attention to the PaCO2 levels and really figure out what's going on with the CO2, because we know that arterial hypocarbia, so low PCO2, has consistently been associated with lousy neurological outcomes, and particularly following cardiac arrest. What we see is that it can cause excessive vasoconstriction of the cerebral vessels, and this in turn worsens ischemia. So we have a brain that's injured, had loss of oxygenation, and then now we're going to limit blood flow to it. Again, a bad combination of events. So we know that the relationship between hypercarbia and neurological outcome is less clear, really not well studied here. But the mechanism behind the association of arterial CO2 and neurological outcome can be influenced by a number of things, right? And so hemodynamic effects of positive pressure ventilation. So the patient prior to arrest was breathing spontaneously. Now we're doing either bagging or intubating and bagging. And this is now positive pressure ventilation, which can in turn limit or impair venous return. This increases right ventricular afterload and in turn lowers cardiac output, something that we don't necessarily want to do to the brain injured patient and have lousy organ perfusion there. Cerebral vasoconstriction and hypoxia can result. And so we know that as we create other secondary injuries, there's modulations of ischemia and then secondary reperfusion injuries. We know that the CO2 also directly affects the vasculature after cardiac arrest, and it's really a major player in the regulation of cerebral blood flow. So we have to be very, very cautious and pay attention to our PCO2 in the patient post-cardiac arrest. Current studies, they suggest that mild hypercarbia may be beneficial. So a mild hypercarbia. So these are only phase 2 and phase 3 trials. Patients randomized to either mild hypercarbia had lower concentrations of neurological sequela. So it's an emerging concept that requires further study. So this isn't a done deal, but everything is leaning in that direction. So the current recommendation is to titrate respiratory rate to target a PaCO2 in the 40 to 50 range. So we're not looking at 40, and we certainly aren't looking less than 40. And we'll do whatever we can do to prevent 32 and below PCO2, because that will result in cerebral vasoconstriction and limit blood flow. So the goal should be a PCO2 of 40 to 50 in hopes of creating a milieu or an environment where the brain is not receiving a secondary injury.
Outstanding, Peter. So we've talked about FiO2. Now we've talked about respiratory rate with respect to CO2, what about actually the tidal volume itself? Rob, we've talked a lot about lung protective ventilatory settings or the use of low tidal volumes in other patient conditions. What about in the post-arrest patient?
Yeah, so although the epidemiology and the pathophysiology of lung injury after cardiac arrest, it's not completely well characterized, we do know a number of things. We know that post-arrest patients are at significant risk for lung injury by a number of mechanisms. Aspiration is one mechanism. Up to 30% of patients post-cardiac arrest have witnessed emesis and aspiration. And the incidence of unwitnessed aspiration and microaspiration is certainly higher than that. Patients who have post-cardiac arrest are certainly at risk for pulmonary contusions because of CPR. And it's been cited that about 40% of patients have pulmonary contusions from this CPR. We've talked briefly about ischemia and reperfusion injury, which affects the lungs. And then, of course, all these patients being on a ventilator are at risk for infections. And the early onset of pneumonia is very common in post-cardiac arrest patients. So overall, there's really a lot of overlap between the various pathophysiologic mechanisms of ARDS and what happens in the post-cardiac arrest syndrome. And you should really just think of it as sort of a pre-ARDS type patient, an acute lung injury type patient. And what do we do with those patients? What do we do with ARDS patients? Well, of course, we provide them with ARDS-NET low tidal volume ventilation. And so there is some early evidence that this low tidal volume ventilation for patients post-cardiac arrest will provide better outcomes, although it's not entirely clarified. But our recommendation here is pretty simple. Just go with low tidal volume ventilation as you would with pretty much any other patient that you're ventilating. And that's really the way to go.
Very, very helpful. So we got goals for FiO2. Now we got goals for PCO2. And definitely because of these risk factors and the similarity in the post-arrest patient with their lung injury, we're going to use low tidal volume strategies, shooting for that 6 mLs per kilogram of predicted body weight. Let me just touch on one thing that you mentioned during that discussion, Rob, and that these patients' early onset pneumonia is fairly common. And something that I got out of this particular article, I didn't realize just how common it was. In fact, the incidence is reported up to 70% of these post-arrest patients can develop pneumonia. And those risk factors, if they had a witnessed aspiration during their event, did they have pre-existing dementia, non-cardiac cause for their arrest, and the use of elevated levels of PEEP actually are risk factors for pneumonia in the post-arrest patient. Now, there is conflicting data regarding whether targeted temperature management is associated with an increase in incidence of pneumonia. We know that from a few multivariable analysis that using or taking patients down to 33 degrees Celsius is associated with an early onset pneumonia, but certainly the data is not clear. Now, in terms of an approach to this patient, more often this is going to be when they're in the intensive care unit, when they're in the coronary care unit, and thinking about those pre-arrest and the peri-arrest factors. Were they someone who had a history of dementia before? Perhaps they aspirated or were seen to aspirate during the setting of their arrest. In these patients who had suspected aspiration, well, you want to do what you would for other patients who have suspected aspiration. That's obtaining samples, cultures from the lower respiratory tract, usually via bronch or perhaps endotracheal aspiration. And then patients at high risk for bacterial pneumonia, we're going to be providing them with antimicrobial therapy. And we do know that delaying antimicrobial therapy, much like other infectious conditions, has been associated with an increase in mortality. I think one of the more take-home points for me is that the incidence is pretty high, once again, close to 70% of pneumonia in these post-arrest patients. So gentlemen, this has been an exceedingly helpful and targeted podcast focusing on the respiratory component of post-cardiac arrest care. We've talked about how important post-cardiac arrest care is as a package, but specifically with respect to ventilator management. John, you did a great job talking about the FiO2 and how we should be titrating down to simply maintain saturations between, say, 92 to 97%, or a PaO2 goal of around 100 millimeters of mercury. Peter, outstanding discussion on targeting that respiratory rate to a PCO2 or PACO2 of around 40 to 50. Definitely excited to hear more to come on that mild hypercapnia. And Rob, very strong in terms of low tidal volume strategy. More and more literature is supporting its use in the post-cardiac arrest patient. Peter, let me ask you first, anything to add in terms of vent management that we haven't touched on?
One of the things that I would be sure to do is elevate the head of the bed to 30 to 45 degrees. You've already mentioned here tonight that their aspiration risks are pretty profound. And so if you even have the hint of aspiration, we should be documenting it in our record for subsequent pneumonia issues. But more importantly, oftentimes we get these CTs of the head and the patient goes to the scanner and is completely supine and comes back to us in the ED completely flat. We need that head of the bed elevated to, again, reduce the risk of further aspiration and complications.
Great, great point. Rob, anything to add?
Not much to add, other than to, again, reemphasize the point about hyperoxia and hyperventilation. These patients, when we resuscitate them, it's usually kind of a high-stress thing getting them back, and instinctively, we tend to overventilate them, we tend to over-oxygenate them. Remember, less is more in these patients. Instead of starting at 100% FiO2 when you're bagging them or when you have them on a ventilator, start low and titrate up. And likewise, don't ventilate them too much. Remember, hypercarbia is better than hypocarbia.
I like that. Less is more. John, bring us home.
Yeah, so all these amazing points. The only other thing that I could possibly add here is that at our institution, we've actually started instituting empiric antibiotic therapy for our post-arrest patients. There are a few papers out there kind of smoldering, and I think we're starting to see a building evidence of clearly there's a risk of pneumonia, and potentially early antibiotics or not giving early antibiotics could potentially be associated with worsened outcomes. So really, really pay attention closely. And if you are concerned at all, don't be afraid to start antibiotics. It's the people upstairs, their job to take it away if the cultures come back negative. But we can lose some ground if we don't hit this early on.
Well, as always, you guys have provided some wonderful teaching pearls, some pitfalls to avoid with respect to the post-arrest patient for this discussion. For any of you listening in and have any questions, please shoot us an email through our website. Very much looking forward to hearing your thoughts and feedback on ventilator management in the post-arrest patient. We've got some great upcoming episodes, some topics to talk about. Much of it has been based on your emails, on your feedback. Really looking forward to next podcast where we're going to do a deep dive into acute aortic syndromes. Looking forward to that discussion. Once again, please email us any questions on the post-arrest vent management. And for now, Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, on behalf of Peter W., Rob Rodriguez, and John Greenwood and CCPEM, have a good night. We'll talk to you next podcast.